The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us tonight. A friendly reminder to please silence your cell phones, with the exception, of course, of rare bird alerts. I'm Joanne Woods, Library Supervisor of the Andorra Branch and founder of the Free Library's Birding Backpack Program. The Birding Backpack Program is a binocular lending program that I hope to expand to every city library. The Free Library of Philadelphia loves birding and fosters environmental stewardship by loaning out birding backpacks, which are available for 3-week loans at select branches citywide, and also by presenting engaging events like this one. It's my pleasure to introduce and tell you about Christian Cooper. Mr. Cooper is the host and consulting producer on National Geographic's Extraordinary Birder TV series. He sits on the board of directors of the New York City Audubon Society. A revolutionary comics writer, he introduced the first lesbian character for Marvel and the first gay male character in the Star Trek universe via Starfleet Academy comic series. He created Queer Nation, the online gay comic. In his book, Better Living Through Birding, Notes from a Black Man in the Natural World, Cooper tells the story of his life leading up to the morning in May 2020 when he was birding in Central Park and had what should have been a routine encounter with a dog walker. Instead, racial tensions erupted, and the dog owner attempted to weaponize the police against him. Cooper's viral video of the incident brought light to this blatant, intentional racial bias, inspired worldwide social justice movements, and launched the tradition of Black Birders Week, a week of celebrating Black naturalists and bringing light to the challenges they face. The book follows Cooper's worldwide avian adventures, offers tips and tricks to beginner birders, and explores his many unique career paths and the intricacies and nuances and challenges he faced personally throughout his life. Better Living Through Birding offers insights into how birding prepared Cooper, a gay Black nerd, or blurred, as he puts it, to overcome so many adversities. Tonight, Christian Cooper will be in conversation with Tamala Edwards, anchor, 6ABC Action News, Morning Edition. I'm so excited to be here tonight, and it's my honor to welcome to the stage Tamala Edwards and Christian Cooper.
Good evening and welcome. I have to tell you, this is my first time meeting Christian. And the first thing I did is I said, can I hug you? This is how much I loved this book. And Christian, what I thought was interesting is, of course, we will get to Amy Cooper. And in the book, you get to Amy Cooper in the end. You have so much more to talk about. And I wondered, when the publisher came to you and said, do you want to do a book? And you said, she's the least of what I want to talk about. How did you get them to say, fine?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to put the incident into context, which I try to do in that chapter, but also to put it into the context of my life, which was that lasted about, you know, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, you know, the video even less. And so, you know, it had ramifications. It was eye-opening for a lot of people, which is why it was important. But in the context of my life, there was so much more that was going on. And actually, I think it helps you understand that moment more, at least from my perspective, if you have some awareness of some of the threads that led up to it, like the history of activism in my family and my own personal activism and, you know, my devotion to birds and all of that. So I think it's where, exactly where it belongs. Plus, you know, then people have something to look forward to when they get to it.
You start the book telling us how you get into birding, a family trip. In the RV, there's a birding book, one of the few things, and you don't just go, ah, this is boring, you really get into it. But you also talk a lot about what it was to realize really early that you were a queer child and how you had to sublimate that. And in fact, at one point, you describe it as being buried alive.
Yeah.
And I wonder, as you were writing this, the Christian today, looking back on that Christian then, knowing what you now know, that 40 years later, Obergefell, the Supreme Court rulings, pride in the streets, so much more freedom, and yet, here we are talking about pulling books out of the library, displays down at Target. Who would have thought? What do you think when you think back on that little boy, that journey in both strands?
Well, I mean, I think from a personal level, you're absolutely right. You know, that is the only metaphor I can think of that accurately describes how it felt. It felt like being buried alive. I think that's one reason why I'm a very optimistic, happy person now, because it's sort of like after that, I'm like, this is all good. I can deal with this. So from a personal level, I think there's that. Looking at the trend of politics, of where the country is, we've come a huge distance, and there is no going back, even though some people are doing their last desperate throes to drag us back. There is no going back because of the young people, because of the young people today who have grown up accepting themselves and who do not question their right to be full human beings in our society. And they will not allow us to go back. They just won't. They haven't grown up the way I did, you know, stifled and smothered. At least some of them haven't. So I look at that trajectory and I'm like, yeah, they're pushing back on us now. They're trying to roll things back today. They will have their small successes. They always do. They will not win.
You know, I look on a lot of things on race that shock me, and I think my grandparents would say, why are you shocked? We could have told you this was coming. When you look at this moment, were you shocked or you kind of knew this was coming?
What moment? This moment here?
The moment where they're yeah, I know you're shocked about being on the stage of the book, but after it seemed as though the Rubicon was crossed, the fact that we are having these arguments around queer issues this way. Were you shocked or you expected it?
To say I expected it would be a lie. I mean, I think we all had in the back of our head the knowledge that, yeah, we've made tremendous progress, but, you know, there are people who are just waiting for their chance, and suddenly they've had their chance. They've been enabled. So to say that I'm not shocked would be a lie. To see the ferocity of this pushback and to see its initial success, to see how much momentum it's gained, is disquieting to say the least. I did not expect it to snap back quite the way it did. It doesn't matter, because as long as we all stand up, it doesn't matter. And that's the thing. We have to be the people to raise our voices and say, okay, you know what? No, we're going to stand with the people who want to be themselves and just live their lives and deal with it or move aside.
What was it about that book when you picked it up on the floor of the RV that you didn't toss it aside? Because that's the spark. That's the moment that your dad is shot. You see a bird and you know what it is.
It had pretty pictures. So I was like, pretty picture. Look at that one. Look at that one. Look at that one. Yeah, so that's what it was. Just flipping through and looking at them. And also a certain degree of, I think, what is that? Can you spot the difference? So, you know, there were some, for example, in the warblers, some that look very similar. I'm like, oh, well, this one has a big, bold white stripe over the eyebrow, and this one, or looking at the magpies, oh, this one has a yellow bill, and this one has a black bill. And, you know, and so all of this just kind of soaks into a little nascent 9-year-old brain, which is full of room and isn't cluttered with all those adult worries. And then, you know, you get to the West Coast, and look, Mom and Dad, a black-billed magpie. And I'm like,
And you were off. In Long Island, as a kid, you start birding, and the book really gets into your journey as a gay man in America. What stunned me often is your full-throated embrace from the very beginning of who you are. I'm a guy who likes comics, who likes sci-fi. I'm a guy who wants to be in these spaces, and you don't really think about how black people or white people feel about it. Because we both know there's a pressure from white people and a pressure from black people, too, for fitting in. How did you, from such an early age, go, I don't fit in any of the boxes and that's cool?
Well, I didn't think it was cool. But I didn't really have a choice. It was just sort of like, you know, this is who I am. And you know, even with the gay thing, you know, I knew it at an early age. I just knew enough to hide it if I wanted to survive. But I thought at one point it might, you know, especially when we're that young, we think, oh, maybe this can change. Maybe I can be cured, something like that. And thank God you reach a point where you're like, yeah, I'm okay with this. And it's not really a problem. Not for me. It may be for other people, but that's their problem. And when you reach that point, you know, then you can actually start to enjoy yourself. So I just don't think there was a choice, you know? It was just what I was into. It was what gave me pleasure. You know, so looking at birds, losing myself in Star Wars, literally going to Star Wars in 1977 and sitting in the movie theater to watch it three times in a row, back to back to back. That brought me joy. So I gave into it.
And I think what stood out to me is, like, as a young man, when you come out of the closet, you blow the hinges off. You tell your friends at freshman year in college, you tell your dad, you tell your mom, you tell everybody.
And except my grandmother. She was took a little while on that one.
And even your life choices, like, everybody's like, you're going to go to law school, right? And you're like, wait, can I be a black gay lawyer? No, I can't, so I guess I'm going to go write comics. That you didn't force yourself to hide, to say, I'm going to go be a lawyer. In the 80s and 90s, a lot of people did not make that choice.
Yeah, but I'd been buried alive. I just dug myself out of the grave. I wasn't going to put myself back in there if I didn't, you know, if there was any way to not do that. And there were plenty of ways not to do that. So, no.
Okay. You talk about in the book, you call it the Vulcan side of yourself, that as you start to realize, I can't tell people these things.
If Doug is out there, he's laughing his butt off.
Doug right there.
There's Doug. Doug is the producer of Extraordinary Birder. So.
I want you to explain to people what Mr. Spock meant to you. And I wondered, you know, in fact, I wondered if I could ask you if I could hug you. Because you said, like, there was this kind of wall that you built. And I wonder if over your life it's something that you have really had to deal with, that Mr. Spock in you. Tell people about that.
Well, no, it's so funny you say that, because there was a friend of mine. I remember, this is going back years, but we were in a bar, and I was a little bit tipsy. And I was hugging him over and over, and he goes, what's wrong with you? You're the king of don't touch me. the Vulcan side. That was my salvation back as a kid, because here I was, you know, a smart, nerdy, geeky kid with not a lot of role models, and then there was Mr. Spock on Star Trek. And he was pure intellect, pure brain, and more importantly, or just as importantly, he was half Vulcan, who was devoted to logic and could not let his emotions show, and with a troublesome human half that was riotously emotional and had to be kept under lock and key. Well, here I was a queer kid, and that part had to be kept under absolute lock and key. I could not be allowed to peek out in any way, shape, or form, or social death, and who knows, possibly real death could occur. So here was a roadmap. You know, here was my hero, who was smart as hell, and who kept it all under control, no matter what. So that became sort of my template. And it's still, to some extent, my template. I've evolved a little bit more so that I can be a little bit more emotional when I can be, should be, sometimes. But yeah, that was my goal, my template.
And through all this, you fall in love with birding. And I wrote down, you know, the subtitle of the book is Better Living Through Birding. And I've said to myself as I read it, how does it make a better life? And I said, you have to have patience and observance, a passion, different senses, and a joy. Did I get that right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it opens you up to the world in a way that you have never experienced before, maybe. I don't know of anything else that opens you up the same way. I mean, you know, hiking can bring you into the natural world, but it's not the same as birding when you've got to focus and you've got to be aware of movement around you, aware of sounds around you. You've got to move outside yourself and be completely engaged with the external universe. What that does is the stuff that you have inside you that's troubling you, that's bothering you, that you're focused on, it's got to slip away, at least for a little while, and you become part of something so much bigger than yourself. And that is a really wonderful experience, and I hope everybody gets to enjoy it by picking up a pair of binoculars and getting out there.
And birding has taken you through so many places, as has your career. You were at a place called Fame, a magazine. That I'm trying to remember. I think that was, I did not remember that, but everybody's heard of Marvel. You were part of history at Marvel, bringing gay characters, lesbian and gay characters, and there's a story about a character named North Star. Mm-hmm. And it's a whole thing over three words, and I thought I'd let you tell the story.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, for those of you who are unfamiliar with Marvel Comics, Marvel's first openly gay character is a character named North Star. He's a mutant who's a super speedster. So for those of you who know The Flash from like the movie that just came out, he's like The Flash. He can run super fast and fly. Anyway, so North Star was this character that had existed in the comics for a long time. I read the comics that he was in, a comic called Alpha Flight, when I was in college. And after reading like two or three issues, I was like, North Star's gay. They, you know, the creator of the comic had layered it in there in subtle and not so subtle ways, and it had always been there. And then by the time I was working at Marvel, my boss Bobby Chase, Bobby being B-O-B-B-I-E, a woman, she was in charge of Alpha Flight, and I was her assistant editor. And she hired a new writer, and the writer said, "Yeah, I think it's time we really made this North Star thing sort of like out of the closet." And Bobby, who has a gay brother and a gay assistant editor, was like, "Yeah, I think that makes sense." And I'm nodding vigorously. I don't really have much to say about it. I'm just like basically the chief Xeroxer as assistant editor, but I'm like, "Yeah, that makes sense." So they did it. Oh boy. The higher-ups, when they found out, blew a gasket, muzzled us all, tried to pull it from the printer. They couldn't because it had already gone to press, and it was all over three words. Because, you know, you think, oh, there must be like some same-sex kiss, or maybe these two guys disrobed together. No, it's like the comic book scene where they're punching each other, villain and superhero, and in between two punches, North Star says the three words, "I am gay." Crisis. But that was, you know, this is the early 1990s, and it was a crisis because everyone knows that comics are only for kids, and everyone knows that things that are gay are not for children. I mean, Ron DeSantis has told us so. Except there are gay kids like me, except that plenty of adults read comics. Just go to your local comic book store, you'll see them. So anyway, that was a whole big, big controversy, and it was because it was Marvel. It was the number one selling comics company on the planet, and for us, you know, you can have alien superheroes, you can have women superheroes, you can have black-white superheroes, you can have disabled superheroes, but you can't have gay superheroes. But we did, and now there are plenty of them. And so, yeah, times change. What's interesting is that, I guess that comic, because it says, "I am gay," would be banned from libraries in Florida right now, in the Florida schools, which is astonishing to me that we have gone back that far. But it won't last.
I think that deserves a round of applause. One of the things I loved about the book is, and as you told your stories, I said to myself, human beings are the treasure. Hearing this man, getting to know him, his travels, his story, this crazy lady at the end, this is the treasure. And part of it was your travels and loving birds, and it takes you everywhere. And it takes you to the Himalaya. I now know it's the Himalaya, not the Himalayas.
You can say the Himalayas, everybody does.
I now know that. And the lesson you learn after a lifetime of control, the best part is when you say to yourself, "Let it go." And that's when the mountain shows itself.
Yeah, yeah, it was almost like, you know, there had been a script written up to that point, because I was tearing my hair out. I was the angry New Yorker trying to elbow my way up the mountain. You know, I'm like angry as heck that we are stifled at every chance we're trying to get up to the base of Mount Everest. We're not climbing the mountain, we're trekking to the base of the mountain. But the weather was against us, there were delays, and it looked like we weren't going to make it. And I was like, why are you working yourself into a lather? That is not the point of being here. You know what? Just let it go. And as soon as I did, it was like a script. Skies parted, skies cleared, mountains showing themselves. I was like, okay, message received. So.
And do you find yourself grateful to birding and birds for this? Because it is your desire to see them that's taken you to all corners of the globe.
Oh, my goodness. I think the two are intertwined. It's not a chicken or an egg thing. I mean, the primary motivation for the Himalaya trip was not birding, in fact. But on the other hand, I never go anywhere without bringing my binoculars, like here to Philadelphia, where this morning I got a live bird at King Rail. Ah! And for those of you at the Heinz National Wildlife Refuge. And for those of you who don't know, Heinz is within the limits of the city of Philadelphia, where I saw a ruby-throated hummingbird, a bald eagle, osprey, and this is the middle of the day, in the middle of the summer when, you know, birding is supposed to be kind of slow. And, you know, I'm getting a life bird of a king rail for, like, I guess we had it in the open for like 15 minutes. For those of you who don't know rails, rails are skulkers. They go into the reeds. You're trying to get a glimpse. This bird was just like, nah, I'm okay. Look at me. So,
in other words, it was a Philly bird.
But anyway, the point is, you know, once you're a birder, pretty much, especially if you're going overseas, you're like, ooh, whole new avifaunal region. Got to bring the binoculars. Life birds all over the place. So it's a chicken or the egg kind of argument.
You know, the book tells your story. And as you read the different parts of it, when you get to Amy Cooper, it really informs how and why you did what you did the way that you did. And part of it is being a child in a home with a parent who could be very difficult and unpredictable and have an explosive temper. And your father was that way. He finally leaves the family. You see him, I think, your freshman year. But then he comes back when you're about 30. And your sister's like, what are you doing? You're traveling with him. And it's about the ups and downs of your relationship. And you take a trip. Where did you go? The first one was Costa Rica. And
first
one was
Costa Rica, yeah.
Then you just try to go to Canada, and it's a freaking disaster.
Oh, it was epically disastrous.
He does not do well with things that are not working out. He does not say, let it go.
No. That was never in Francis Cooper's vocabulary.
And something happens, and you're washing dishes, and you realize your hands are shaking. Mm. And you're like, I'm back to being that 9-year-old again. Mm-hmm. And he's yelling at you. And I'm going to read out loud. We're going to do two readings. I'm going to do one, and Christian's going to do the other. Mm. Because there's a phrase in here that the rest of you should take with you forward into your life. So you're right, looking at your hands. I looked at them astonished at their betrayal. Here I was, a grown man of some 30 years, and yet my hands had reverted to those of a terrified 9-year-old. I'd been reduced by his bullying into a child again. This would not stand. I would not allow it. The grown man reasserted himself and decided then and there that he had something to say about it. And here's what he said. What the fuck is wrong with you? You've been an asshole all day, treating me like a piece of shit when you speak to me at all. And for what? Because some weather derailed our trip. That's the cause to be a fucking jerk to me? I don't know what damage has gone on in that brain of yours that you can't deal with your foul mood without turning to the nearest person into a punching bag. But understand this. I do not have to put up with it. I put up with it my whole childhood, but guess what? Those days are done. I have a wallet full of credit cards that will get me on the first bus back to New York if you don't check yourself. And I'll leave your tired ass here alone. You don't get to do this to me anymore. I've said it, and I'm glad I said it. I think right there, that camping trip saved me a couple $1,000s in therapy. it becomes a family phrase. I've said it, and I'm glad I said it. You know, I wrote down, thinking about how to talk about your dad, hurt people, but you can't just let a person hurt you. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about what it took to get to that moment and what it took to be able to see your father differently. Because after that trip, he's not perfect, but you all come to have a wonderful relationship after 30 difficult years and him having his issues.
What's the question again?
I was, you know, after reading that, part of your ability to do that shows up in your ability to deal with Amy Cooper. We'll get to that in a minute. But I wanted to talk to you about you and Francis. Seeing how he's hurt, being able to see that, and not just be angry with him, but figure out a different way to get through to him and have a relationship with him.
I had an understanding of him and how there was just something broken in the way he responded to things. And knowing that, suddenly what in my childhood I had internalized and made about me, and oh my God, he must hate me or whatever, and I realized it's not me, it's him. He's the one who is having, for whatever reason, and I could guess the reason, having seen a little bit of my grandfather and the environment he must have grown up in, that has left him in that damaged place, that he's got to take it out on the people he loves the most. It was so tragic, and that's why he called the chapter The Tragedy of Francis, that the way he showed love was to brutalize the people he loved the most when something went wrong. And it didn't matter that this person had nothing to do with what was the source of his bad mood, of his foul mood. It just had to go somewhere, and that's where it went, to the people he loved the most. And understanding that didn't really make it easy. You know, you still clap back at him when he did it, and my stepmother, Miriam, clapped back at him hard when he did it. And I worship the woman to this day because she put up with a lot from him and helped him to get better, especially with us being me and my sister. So, but you still gotta push back against it, but the understanding that it wasn't anything about me, that it was his hurt, his brokenness, somehow made it easier to deal with.
But Christian, it was about you, because your ability to stand up for yourself, you kind of gave him a gift. You forced him to come into your life in a different way, and not everybody could do that. And that leads to the thing I wanted you to read, because you all have this relationship, you're going to movies, you're doing things, and it's beautiful. And it was a reminder, human beings can change, and life can surprise you. And I wanted you to read, your dad gets sick, and it's at the end and the family is around. And here's a man who you were just afraid of his booming voice for most of your childhood. And yet, this is how it was almost at the end. Yeah. When I'm telling you this book is about more than Amy Cooper, this book is about more than Amy Cooper.
I'm going to back it up a little earlier, just like a couple of sentences earlier.
Okay.
So I get to
That's
do,
fine.
So
it's your book. You can read what you want to
so
read.
So that I get to do the Francis Cooper voice.
Okay.
I might have died, he said melodramatically, half joking, half accusatory. That phrase had long ago become a refrain. But you didn't, I replied, continuing to snack on nuts unperturbed. Stupid movies you've seen 100 times are more important than your father. I rolled my eyes. Speaking of stupid movies, we were watching one together because TV viewing was one of the few things left for him to pass the time in bed. The mindless entertainment we were largely ignoring was 2004's Troy, starring Brad Pitt, Eric Bana, and Peter O'Toole in the legendary tale of the Trojan War. The drama pierced our conversation from time to time, long enough to hold our attention, one such moment being as Hector is about to go to his certain death in single combat with Achilles. Hector's father, King Priam, struggles for words for the brave, doomed Prince of Troy. No father ever had a finer son, Peter O'Toole's Priam tells him through tearing eyes. I do, my father said clearly. No almost as ifs about it. It was so unexpected, Melody gasped. The rest of the family turned their eyes on me. I kept my mouth busy eating the nuts and my gaze glued to the TV, although I can't say what happened in the rest of the movie. Something had gone wrong with my eyes, like Peter O'Toole's.
you get into a little bit the mystery of Francis, and I wanted to ask you about that. Will you tell people a little bit about the history and how he was found as a little boy and why that matters?
Oh, man. This is the source of a huge family schism that has only and interestingly just healed. My dad was raised not by his mother. His mother abandoned, or the family legend that my father told us was that his mother abandoned the family. He and his three sisters took him and the youngest sister along with her, actually, to the train station where she was going to run off with another man, then changed her mind at the last minute, ran off with the man, but left him and my aunt at the train station, little kids with a sign on them saying, "You can keep your nigger babies." Needless to say, this woman was persona non grata in our family, and my dad hated her with a fiery passion for his entire life. And then the twist, if you will, is that in the final days of my father's life, when he was basically only semi-coherent and had clarity of thought only sometimes because cancer and was kicking in a big way, it was discovered through my niece doing 23andMe, we were reconnected with that branch of the family, basically my dad's first cousin, who he didn't know existed, the daughter of his mother's sister. And she contacted the family, and of course their side has a completely different story, which is that my grandfather was a tyrant and abusive, kicked her out of the house, my grandmother out of the house, and told her never to come back and that she couldn't take the kids. All parties are long gone. No one knows what the truth is. Probably the truth, as usual, is someplace in the middle, somewhere in between. I have no doubt that my grandfather was an absolute tyrant. It's also true that my grandmother never made any attempt to contact the children again, even in adulthood, after my grandfather was long gone. So who knows? But that was the sort of instigating pain in my dad's life. And when we found out this other version of the story, we debated whether or not to try to tell him, even through the haze that he was in, and we decided not to, because we thought it would be wrong to yank away, you know, at this stage in his life, to yank away the underpinnings of what he had lived with his whole life. And maybe that was the wrong decision, I don't know, but, you know, we did that in consultation with his eldest sister, my aunt. And we all three agreed that me, my sister Melody, and Aunt Alita, that we weren't going to do that. The fascinating thing was Aunt Alita, who in her 90s saw a picture of her mother for the first time since she had been like 10 years old. I can't even imagine what that was like for her. So, but what's nice is that our cousin, who we have now all met and hung out with, is a lovely person. And so finally, at last, whatever the roots of the schism in the family, it's healing. And that's a nice coda to the story.
If you can just get some birds in there, I think you have another book. And so that brings us to Amy Cooper. And at this point, so many people know the story. You're in the Rambles. She won't leash the dog. You've decided you have a way of dealing with people when they won't do that. You have treats because the dog will come to you. People don't like seeing the dog come to you. And then they will leash the dog. And then it gets into taping her. Part of that was something that you all did, birders, because you set up early in the book that to be a birder in New York City is to get cursed out pretty regularly because people don't want to leash their dogs. But you also in the book say you were thinking of Philando Castile. I wanted you to talk about a triangle you find yourself in. Philando caused you to pull out your phone. George would happen within a few hours of your event that day. And you all are sort of tied in a cosmic space in a triangle. Very different outcomes for them, a different trajectory for you.
I think that's why after the incident happened, my first instinct was to hide under a rock until it all blew over and I could get back to my life. And gradually came to realize that was the wrong response because I, unlike Philando Castile, unlike George Floyd, still had the ability to articulate what was going on and what this moment meant and that I had an obligation to do that. And so that's the point in which I'm like, all right, so I have to take this on, and I can't hide under the rock. As far you've gotten the Philando Castile thing slightly wrong. Philando Castile isn't why I decided to record. Philando Castile is why I decided to keep recording, and that was a crucial moment, because after she makes her attempt at racial intimidation to get me to stop recording, I almost did. Part of me was like, oh, wow, I know what this is as a black man in America to have a white woman falsely accuse you, and who will likely be believed? This is a world of trouble heading my way. If I turn off this video recorder, maybe it all goes away. And I almost did. And that's the point at which I thought of Philando Castile. Because Philando Castile did all the things you're supposed to do, that black mothers tell their sons that you're supposed to do. He was respectful to the police officer. You guys probably need a little bit of background. Philando Castile was an African-American guy driving in, ironically, Minneapolis, where George Floyd would happen a couple of years later. Got pulled over in a routine traffic stop. Respectful to the police officer. Kept his hands on the steering wheel. Volunteered to the police officer, sir, I just want you to know I have a gun in the car, just so you know. It is a registered handgun. I am licensed to carry. And that police officer still shot him dead, sitting there in his seat of his car with his girlfriend sitting next to him and a little baby child sitting in the back seat watching the whole thing. And when that happened, I thought about, well, what would I have done in his situation so that I could have come out of this alive? And there was nothing. There was absolutely nothing I or any black person could have done in that situation to change the outcome. And that's why I thought of Philando Castile when she, you know, tried to get me to stop recording. And I thought, you know what? They're going to shoot us no matter what we do. And if I'm going out, I'm going out with my dignity intact. I'm not going to be complicit in my own dehumanization. I am not going to make this easy for her. I'm going to do what any person would do if they were black, brown, green, whatever. I'm just going to keep recording until that dog is on the leash like I originally intended. And she's just going to have to do what she feels she needs to do in response. So that's where Philando Castile came in. It is an odd place to be in that sort of relationship between George Floyd and Philando Castile. But if nothing else, it's given maybe a window into those situations to a lot of people who hadn't thought about it or understood it before. And so that's at least a little good to come out of all of that, maybe.
Do you think sometimes because you're a Harvard-educated, middle-class man, they can hear you in a way that people sometimes try to undercut George Floyd or Philando Castile?
Yes, I'm fluent in Harvard. I think that's absolutely true. I think, and that was one of the points a lot of people made, is that it's great that all these people are according this deference to Christian Cooper, but it should be accorded to everybody. You know, every black person.
In the book, one of the things I didn't realize, you get into, it was almost crazy making. She would, on the phone, bend over and rasp and then stand up straight and talk to you. And I don't know that people, you know, they just see what's on the video. They may not realize, like, you were seeing in real time her play act.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the things that has come out lately is that the 911 operator on the other end of the line apparently was having trouble hearing her. And so that might have added to her agitation, and it may have. But I also know what happened after the camera was off, when the dog was finally on the leash, and I was like, dog's on the leash, video goes off, goodbye. And she's suddenly all calm again, and she's like, oh, well, now that I've called the police, you turn the recording off. I'm like, no, now that your dog's off the leash, I turn the recording off. And just at that moment, because up until then it had been just me and her, this white guy comes walking up the path, and she goes right into it. And she doubles over, and the rasp is back, and she's like, please get help. And the guy, and I just looked at the guy and said, I just asked her to leash her dog. And he looked at me, and he looked at her, and he looked at me. A poor guy, I don't know what was going through his head, or I don't know what I would have done in that situation, but I was like, I'm done here, and I just went about birding again.
But I think that is so important, because you know, after she does her bit, you just keep walking. You almost don't even look back. And you realize the police could show up and think about it a little bit as you leave the park. But you do what you intended to do.
That was important to me, because that's why I got up at 5:30, got up at 4 in the morning, was to go burning, not to deal with her, and she does not get to derail my life.
But so, this is why I think this is so significant. As I was thinking about you, I thought of this quote from Toni Morrison when she was asked about the danger of racism and what it does. And she said the function, the very serious function of racism, is distraction. It keeps you from doing your work. It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being. Somebody says you have no language and you spend 20 years proving that you do. Somebody says your head isn't shaped properly, so you have scientists working on the fact that it is. Somebody says you have no art, so you dredge that up. Somebody says you have no kingdom, so you dredge that up. None of this is necessary. There will always be one more thing. I thought that was such an astounding act of liberation that after that happened, you went birding.
Well, and here's the other act of liberation that we're going to do right now, which is that we're going to stop talking about Amy Cooper because it's a distraction. She is not the important part here. The important part is the bias that got revealed in that moment. And there are things we can do about that bias that we see every day. We can work on changing the bias and how it gets acted out in the criminal justice system, which led to such tragic and more dramatic and important consequences with George Floyd. We can change the bias that acts out in our political system. If you look at the fact that Washington, D.C. has 600,000 people, most of them or a lot of them black and brown, but no representation whatsoever, voting representation. But you look at Wyoming with fewer people than Washington, D.C., but mostly rural and white, and they get two senators. You look at Vermont, mostly rural and white, and they get two senators, even though they have less people than Washington, D.C. Distractions? Amy Cooper is a distraction. The thing we need to focus on is ourselves, and we need to focus on fixing those things we can fix, which is things like the political system so that black and brown people in D.C. get their fair representation. That's just one aspect of bias we can be working on.
I have two quick questions for Christian, then we're going to turn it over to you, so start thinking about what it is that you want to ask. In the aftermath, it's a little crazy. You talk about Inside Edition slanting things from the right. You talk a little bit about the DA slanting things from the left. But one thing that you talked about that really stood out to me is that the number of people who wanted a reconciliation for you with a woman who never bothered to apologize to you.
She apologized in the press, sort of.
That's not an apology.
Yeah.
Why do you think everybody else was so focused on reconciliation?
I don't know. It's fascinating. And it was almost exclusively white people who said this to me. For some reason, it was really important to them that this be made right, as some people even put it that way. And I'm like, I don't need it. I'm not looking for it. If she does, that's on her. So I don't understand where that came from. Almost as if, you know, something need to be whole. If something could be made whole in this incident, it would heal all our other ills, which it wouldn't. So I don't know where that comes from.
You have a new show on National Geographic where people get to watch you run around in life with your heart out looking at birds.
Excuse me, heart out. You're speaking to a wannabe Vulcan. That's an insult.
You've got this book, Better Living Through Birding, and I'm telling you, it's got tips and stories that you will have better living. What do you want people who watch that show or read this book, what do you want them to take from it?
Well, I want everybody to engage with the wild, and in particular, because I love them, through birds. I think it is healing. I think it is life-changing. I think it is eye-opening. I think it opens all of us up to the world in new ways. And it's remarkable how it opens us up to each other. Maybe not permanently, maybe not deeply, but it's a start. I can't tell you the number of times I've run into total strangers when I'm birding, and that birding allows a connection that lets us deal with each other, again, maybe not deeply. I don't know their politics. Their politics may be the exact opposite of mine. But at least for that little while, it doesn't matter. And there's a connection we have, which is sharing the beauty of that bird. And it's a start, you know? So I hope lots of people tune into the show and get inspired to look outside your window. You don't even have to step outside. If you have some sort of mobility issues, you can do it bird from your window. You don't have to have binoculars. For a lot of people, that's a barrier to entry because they can be an expensive piece of equipment. You know what? You can just use your eyes and your ears. So I hope everybody engages that way. And certainly with the book, you know, there are things I have been fighting for my whole life, long before the incident, which is justice for black people, equality for queer people, and birds and their preservation for all people. And this just gives me another chance to do that and maybe reach out to people in a way, by making it personal, that people can access a little bit more easily. So I hope the book accomplishes some of that. If it gets people outside, if it inspires especially young black and brown kids, because we're horribly still underrepresented in birding, though things have gotten better. Yes, in color birding of Philadelphia, who are sitting in the front row and who have been doing tremendous work to change that. So you might want to look them up and get involved with them if you have any interest. But it's changing, but especially if I can inspire those young black and brown kids, if they see somebody like me doing it and think, oh, maybe I can do that too. But if I inspire all people to get out there and get involved in birding, that then mission accomplished.
I want to say thank you to Christian for the book. What I took from it is it all matters. All the things, good, bad, it all matters because it helps you when it matters to show up for yourself. So thank you for the book. Mm-hmm. Do we have questions in the audience?
In your personal opinion with regard to birding, are ivory-billed woodpeckers extinct or they're not? I keep hearing all these weird stories.
I told you your people were coming out.
That is an excellent question. I hold out hope. They found some, if I remember correctly, in the 80s in Cuba that they weren't expecting to find. So I have my fingers crossed, hope against hope, that they're still out there. If the show gets a second season, maybe we'll devote an episode to the search for the ivory-billed woodpecker. Who knows? But I hold out hope. I have not given up hope. Are they still? Nobody knows.
I got to get out with these people. I'm fascinated.
Hi, Chris. So we're actually on episode 4 of Extraordinary Birdo. We're really enjoying the program, and I really love that you brought this like pure joy to the experience of birding. I think a lot of experienced birders are very oh yeah, it's a robin. I've seen it a billion times. And I just love that you devote so much time to just appreciating a robin in D.C. And I guess I was just curious how much of a say you had in the making of the program, like where you decided to go and what birds to focus on, what activities to do. Like in New York, you go to the Wild Bird Fund, that kind of thing.
Doug, am I allowed to answer that? As I said earlier, Doug Bythe, our producer, is here in the audience. When we started, these guys knew making great television, but they didn't know birds. And I knew birds. So certainly in picking some of the locations, I had a big hand in that. What these guys are incredible professionals. So even though they started not knowing birds, boy, did they learn quickly. And so they did their research, and they found a lot of things in these places that I had picked that they were like, oh, let's go here. Let's go. Let's do this. Let's talk to this person. And in almost every case, they picked the right stuff to do. So it was a collaborative effort. But, you know, they did the heavy lifting.
Hi, I'm Jen. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Jen.
Hi. So I have two questions.
Yes.
One from my 14-year-old daughter, and she couldn't make it today, but she really wanted to ask you, are you having a big year?
I am not. I have never done a big year, and I think part of the reason is because I think it would leech some of the fun out of it for me, because you become sort of obsessed with, you know, ticking off the bird so that you get it on your list for the year without really appreciating the bird in the moment.
It's expensive, too.
Yeah, so no, I haven't done a big year. Maybe I'll sing a different song at some point, but I haven't done one yet.
Can you explain to those who are...
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. A big year is where you try to see as many birds as possible within a designated area in a single year. So you can do a big year for the continental United States, or you can do a big global big year. But that's where in a single year you're trying to get
everything that can be seen. And usually there are other people you are in competition with who are trying to outrace you. And there was actually a book and a movie done about it. The movie stars Steve Martin and Owen
Jack
Wilson
Black.
And Jack Black. Yes, exactly. Called The Big Year,
it's
where
hilarious.
These three guys are like in competition to try to hit that highest number for the year. It's actually kind of fun. It's a nice movie.
And one last question for me. Have you ever been to Cape May?
I was to Cape May once when I was a teen, many, many, many years ago. Many, 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 many years ago.
Okay.
And
during migration?
Yeah, it was fall migration, and I was not the birder I am today, so I don't know that I was able to take as much advantage of it as I would today if I was in Cape May. Doug, Cape May.
Christian, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good to see you again.
This is Edge.
This is Edge.
Hey.
How are you? So I don't bird outside the city unless I have a white shield with me, and a white shield is just a white person. So I was wondering if you could speak to how having the crew with you has enabled you to go bird places you never thought you could for safety reasons.
Well, we went to Alabama. No, it's a very good question. And this is, I think, for many white birders out there, this is something that might never have crossed your mind, but it definitely crosses the mind of black birders, is do I feel safe and comfortable birding in this particular place? For example, I don't think I would have gone to Alabama to bird on my own under any circumstances, just because, and maybe that's a mischaracterization of Alabama. Having now done it, you know, I'm like, okay, there's definitely ways to bird Alabama. But on the other hand, I still know Alabama is still Alabama, and there are parts of Alabama where I would not want to be caught alone with a pair of binoculars around my neck wandering around, you know, in a predominantly white area. It would not end well. So we have to be aware of that. So I think what Edge means by a white shield is someone white who's there birding with you, who can have your back. And for those of you who are white birders, when you see a black birder, or if you are birding with a black person, keep that in mind, that you have the ability to protect them, to make sure that they are not hassled, to have their back, so that we can all, regardless of race, regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, trans or in drag, it doesn't matter. We should all be able to go out there and pick up a pair of binoculars and look at the birds. So.
There's a question in the back, all the way in the back.
Good evening. I had a question more, I guess, on the social justice side. I know you said representation, and I know you went to Harvard. I went to a boarding school, so understanding the good old boy network, the fraternal things that come with it. And I went to school down south, hearing the South Shall Rise Again, Confederate flags in my friend's room. How do you believe we go about effectuating change when the problems are systemic? And like you said, not focusing on Amy Cooper and also focusing on the issues themselves. Sorry.
If I had the easy answer to that, I'd probably have a Nobel Prize right now. I think it's just the work we all have to take on ourselves, particularly reaching out to the next generation, because really, you know, we old people have so much baggage, and the young people at least, they have hope, they have open minds. We can maybe steer them in new directions. But I think some of it is what you talked about. It's you know, standing up for what we believe in and living our lives as authentically as we can as individuals, doing, as you said, not allow, or as you repeated what I had said about, you know, not allowing ourselves to get distracted and focusing on the issues. There are political things we can do to make things better and to give more space for black and brown people to live our lives just like anybody else. So we can work on those. There is no easy answer. I wish there was.
So that's the end of this section of the program. Are you signing books out there tonight?
I think so.
Then there's an opportunity to buy a book and get it signed and spend a little time with Christian Cooper. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.